across Northern Ireland, Northern England and Scotland, turning icy behind it, southern areas will be mainly dry and chilly. On Sunday, another Atlantic weather system will push cloud, rain and wind eastwards across the UK. Northern Ireland first to get all of that in the morning. The eastern side of the UK won't see any substantial rain until late afternoon or evening. So there it is. Even if in the weather world they call this the start of spring, it seems the winter rain just carries on. Back to you, David.
Thanks very much, Nick. Now on BBC Radio 4, Book of the Week, Solomon Northup's memoir, 12 Years a Slave, which inspired Steve McQueen's Oscar-nominated film, is an unflinching account of the realities of slavery and racism in 1850s America. In this final extract, Solomon finds an ally who helps him to regain his freedom. The reader is Rashaan Stone.
In the month of June, 1852, Mr. Avery, a carpenter of Bayou Rouge, commenced the erection of a house for Master Epps. Having had some experience under Tibbetts as a carpenter, I was taken from the field on the arrival of Avery and his hands. Among them was one to whom I owe an immeasurable debt of gratitude. His name was Bass. He was a large man, between 40 and 50 years old, of light complexion and light hair. He was very cool and self-possessed, fond of argument, but always speaking with extreme deliberation. He was that kind of person whose peculiarity of manner was such that nothing he uttered ever gave offense. What would be intolerable coming from the lips of another could be said by him with impunity. There was not a man on Red River, perhaps, that agreed with him on the subject of politics or religion, and not a man, I venture to say, who discussed either of those subjects half as much. It seemed to be taken for granted that he would espouse the unpopular side of every local question, and it always created amusement rather than displeasure among his auditors to listen to the ingenious and original manner in which he maintained the controversy. He was a native of Canada, from whence he had wandered in early life. One day, while working on the new house, Bass and Epps became engaged in a controversy, to which, as will be readily supposed, I listened with absorbing interest. They were discussing the subject of slavery.
"Now, I'll tell you what it is, Epps," said Bass. "It's all wrong. All wrong, sir. There's no justice nor righteousness in it. I wouldn't own a slave if I was as rich as Croesus, which I am not. What right have you to your niggers when you come down to the point?" "What right?" said Epps, laughing. "Why, I bought him, and I paid for him." "Well, of course you did. The law says you have the right to hold a nigger, but, begging the Lord's pardon, it lies. Is everything right because the law allows it? Suppose they pass a law taking away your liberty and making you a slave." "Oh, that ain't a supposable case," said Epps, still laughing. "Hope you don't compare me to a nigger, Bass." "Well," Bass answered gravely, "no, not exactly. But I have seen niggers before now as good as I am, and I have no acquaintance with any white man in these parts that I consider a whit better than myself. Now, in the sight of God, what is the difference, Epps, between a white man and a black one?" "All the difference in the world," replied Epps.
Conversations like the foregoing were not unusual between the two after this. The more I saw of Bass, the more I became convinced he was a man in whom I could confide. Nevertheless, my previous ill fortune had taught me to be extremely cautious. In the early part of August, he and myself were at work alone in the house, the other carpenters having left, and Epps being absent in the field. We were busily at work in the afternoon when I stopped suddenly and said, "Master Bass, I want to ask you what part of the country you came from."
"Why, Platt, what put that into your head?" he answered. After a moment or two, he added, "I was born in Canada. Now, guess where that is?"
"Oh, I know where Canada is," said I. "I have been there myself."
"Here, I expect you are well acquainted all through that country," he remarked, laughing incredulously. "As sure as I live, Master Bass," I replied, "I have been there. I have been in Montreal and Kingston and Queenston and a great many places in Canada. And I have been in York State, too, and can tell you the names of the villages on the Erie Canal and the Champlain Canal." Bass turned round and gazed at me a long time without uttering a syllable. "Well, how's this?" said he. "You have been in Canada, sure enough. I know all the places you mention. How did you happen to get here?" "I am afraid to tell you," was my reply, "though I don't believe you would tell Master Epps if I should." He assured me earnestly he would keep every word I might speak to him a profound secret, and his curiosity was evidently strongly excited. It was a long story. Having ended it, I besought him to write to some of my friends at the North, acquainting them with my situation and begging them to forward free papers or take such steps as they might consider proper to secure my release. He promised to do so, but dwelt upon the danger of such an act in case of detection, and now impressed upon me the great necessity of strict silence and secrecy. I gave him the names of William Perry, Cephas Parker, and Judge Marvin, all of Saratoga Springs, Saratoga County, New York. I had been employed by the latter in the United States Hotel, and had transacted business with the former to a considerable extent, and trusted that at least one of them would be still living at that place. The next day, being Sunday, he employed himself in his own room writing letters. 6, 7, 8, and 10 weeks passed by, however, and nothing came. Finally, my master's house was finished, and the time came when Bass must leave me. The night before his departure, I was wholly given up to despair. Monday morning, the 3rd of January, 1853, we were in the field betimes. Looking up, we saw two men approaching us through the cotton field. One of them, the sheriff. He inquired, "Where's the boy they call Platt?" I wondered to myself what business he could possibly have with me. "Your name is Platt, is it?" "Yes, master," I responded. "Do you know that man?" he demanded. I looked in the direction indicated, and as my eyes rested on his countenance, a world of images thronged my brain, a multitude of well-known faces, my wife Anne's and the dear children's, and my old dead father's, all the scenes and associations of childhood and youth, all the friends of other and happier days appeared and disappeared, until at last the perfect memory of the man recurred to me, and throwing up my hands towards heaven, I exclaimed, "Thank God! Thank God!" In an instant, I comprehended the nature of his business and felt that the hour of my deliverance was at hand. I started towards him, but the sheriff stepped before me. "Stop a moment," said he. "Have you any other name than Platt?" "Solomon Northup is my name, master," I replied. "Have you a family?" he inquired. "I had a wife and three children." "What were your children's names?" "Elizabeth, Margaret, and Alonzo." "And your wife's name before her marriage?" "Anne Hampton." "Where does that gentleman live?" Again, pointing to my friend, "He lives in Sandy Hill, Washington County, New York," was the reply. He was proceeding to ask further questions, but I pushed past him, unable longer to restrain myself. I seized my old acquaintance by both hands. Henry B. Northup, counselor at law and a relative of the family in which my forebears were held to service, and from which they took the name I bear. I could not speak. I could not refrain from tears. "Saul," he said at length, "I'm glad to see you." I essayed to make some answer,
but emotion choked all utterance, and I was silent. The slaves, utterly confounded, stood gazing upon the scene. For 10 years, I had dwelt among them, in the field and in the cabin. Nevertheless, not until this hour, the last I was to remain among them, had the remotest suspicion of my true name or my real history been entertained by any one of them. Epps stood by the gate, conversing with the driver. He swore if he had only had an hour's notice of his coming, he would have saved him the trouble of taking me back to New York, that he would have run me into the swamp, or some other place out of the way, where all the sheriffs on earth couldn't have found me. Patsy ran from behind a cabin and threw her arms about my neck. "Oh, Platt," she cried, tears streaming down her face. "You're going to be free. You're going way off yonder where we'll never see you no more. You saved me a good many whipping, Platt. I'm glad you're going to be free. But, oh, what'll become of me?" I disengaged myself from her and entered the carriage. The driver cracked his whip, and away we rolled. I looked back and saw Patsy, with drooping head, half reclining on the ground. Mrs. Epps was on the piazza. The other slave stood by the gate, gazing after me. I waved my hand, but the carriage turned a bend of the bayou, hiding them from my eyes forever. Taking passage on the first steamer that arrived, we were soon floating down Red River, up which, with such desponding thoughts, I had been born 12 years before. We reached Sandy Hill in the night of the 21st of January, 1853. My heart overflowed with happiness as I looked around upon old familiar scenes and found myself in the midst of friends of other days. The following morning, I started for the residence of Anne and our children. As I entered their comfortable cottage, Margaret was the first that met me. She did not recognize me. When I left her, she was but 7 years old. Now she was grown to womanhood, was married, with a bright-eyed boy standing by her side. Not forgetful of his unfortunate grandfather, she had named the child Solomon. When told who I was, she was overcome with emotion and unable to speak. Presently, Elizabeth entered the room and Anne came running, having been informed of my arrival. They embraced me, and with tears flowing down their cheeks, hung upon my neck. When the violence of our emotions had subsided to a sacred joy, when the household gathered round the fire, we conversed of the 1,000 events that had occurred, the hopes and fears, the joys and sorrows, the trials and troubles we had each experienced during the long separation. My narrative is at an end. I have no comments to make upon the subject of slavery. Those who read this book may form their own opinions of the peculiar institution. This is no fiction, no exaggeration. Chastened and subdued in spirit by the sufferings I have borne, and thankful to that good being through whose mercy I have been restored to happiness and liberty, I hope henceforward to lead an upright, though lowly, life, and rest at last in the churchyard where my father sleeps.
Rashaan Stone was reading 12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup. The book was abridged by Robin Brooks and produced by Kirstine Cameron. Now just a minute to go before we find out what the weather's doing across the waters around our shores. It's a shipping forecast. This is BBC Radio 4, and now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Saturday the 1st of March. There are warnings of gales in Biscay, Trafalgar and Fitzroy. The general synopsis at 1800, low northern France 997, expected Humber 998, by 1800 today. New low moving southeastwards, expected Fitzroy 999 by the same time. Low Faroes 982, expected southeast Iceland 982 by that time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking north at Sarah, southerly 5 to 7, showers good. South at Sarah, southeasterly 4 or 5, occasionally 6 later, showers good. 40s, Cromarty 4th, southwest 4 or 5.